Hello, my name is Dave Emery, and this is Side 2 of For the Record program number 301, Mickey Mauschwitz, The Dark Side of Walt Disney. We're accessing a book called Walt Disney, Hollywood's Dark Prince, authored by Mark Elliott and published in hardcover by Birch Lane Press. Books, copyright 1993. We've been talking about Walt Disney's seminal role in developing or precipitating the Hollywood blacklisting crisis and the anti-communist witch hunts that took place in Hollywood in the late 1940s and 1950s. It was actually during the closing year or so of World War II that Walt helped to intensify Hollywood investigations into and suspicion of the motion picture industry, doing that in part because of his own reactionary political sentiments, his own anti-Semitic sentiments, and also because Walt Disney wanted to gain revenge against a relatively closed system of heads of major studios whom he felt had frankly wronged him and helped to exclude him from his his rightful place in the pantheon, I guess one could say, of Hollywood filmdom. Before the break, we took a look at Walt Disney's alignment with Sam Goldwyn, whom he personally despised. And Goldwyn had had some problems distributing a movie called Up in Arms, starring Danny Kaye. And it was Walt Disney's alliance with Sam Goldwyn in order to help get the picture Up in Arms off the ground, so to speak, that not only deepened Walt's own involvement with the red hunting and blacklisting phase of Hollywood, but which also helped to precipitate one of the most important relationships that Walt Disney had forged in this period, namely his long and active relationship with the FBI. Turning to Hollywood's Dark Prince, we read, by 1944, most of the nation's theaters were owned outright by the Big Five, unquote, Paramount, Lowe's, Warner's, 20th Century Fox, and RKO. According to the terms of his distribution deal with RKO, Goldwyn had final approval of every theater gaining most favored rates whenever his films ran in movie houses RKO owned. However, in territories where RKO had no theaters, Goldwyn had agreed to whatever terms the studio dictated, and as a result, a Goldwyn film in a theater owned by another studio usually earned as little as 1/8 as much as it did in a movie house owned by RKO. When T&D Theaters, a Fox-owned chain based in Reno, Nevada, offered what Goldwyn considered an insulting amount to exhibit Up in Arms, Disney advised him that as one of the original members of the SIMPP, the Society of Independent Motion Picture Producers, he should challenge T&D's right to dictate terms. With Disney's help, Goldwyn then arranged a screening of Up in Arms in Antonio's El Patio, a local Reno nightclub, rather than in a traditional movie theater. The town's commissioners and the Reno Fire Department issued multiple violations for everything from the safety of the carbon arc projection equipment to the lack of permanently floor-anchored seats. Goldwyn overcame the fire department's objections by announcing his intention to donate the opening night proceeds to the Reno branch of the Red Cross. On the evening of August 22nd, just before the film was scheduled to be screened, Goldwyn stood up before the packed house, filled with more reporters than ordinary filmgoers, and stated his intention to fight, quote, a monopoly which has been able to keep independent producers from showing their films unless the producers are willing to pay prohibitive percentages, unquote. Goldwyn then invited Disney to add his voice to the proceedings, and in an impassioned speech that praised Goldwyn for his courage in taking on the monopolistic forces, unquote, of the film industry, Walt concluded by saying, I heartily endorse your efforts to carry directly to the people of Reno and indirectly to the American public the question of whether the motion picture industry as an industry should continue to exist under American competition principles or be throttled by monopolistic restrictions and limitations. Our government has recognized the importance of American films as political and commercial assets in foreign relations for America, unquote. The controversy that surrounded Up in Arms catapulted an otherwise quite ordinary film into a major financial success. However, the real victory for Disney and SIMPP lay elsewhere. When Walt returned to Los Angeles, he immediately filed a complete report on the proceedings with the FBI. The next day, J. Edgar Hoover put T&D Junior Enterprises under investigation for possible antitrust activities. And again, this marked the genesis of Walt Disney's long and very significant relationship with the FBI, and that relationship in turn had much to do with some of the anti-communist witch hunting that took place in Hollywood. And time permitting, near the end of this side, we're going to take a look at how some of Walt Disney's own red hunting, so to speak, ultimately came back to bite him when he himself came under suspicion for leftist or communist associations for having attended a professional gathering, which he did largely in order to spy on some of the leftists that were present. We're going to hear here about a very important figure who not only was instrumental in helping to formalize the Hollywood blacklisting and the professional reaction in Hollywood in the McCarthy period, but who also was later appointed by Ronald Reagan as chairman of the Federal Service Impasse Panel, which arbitrated disputes between federal agencies and the unions that represented federal workers. That fellow was Roy Brewer. He succeeded a Chicago-based gangster named Willie Beoff as the head of the International Association of Theatrical and Stage Employees. That was a mob-controlled union, and Frank Nitti, the assistant to Al Capone, who succeeded Al Capone, portrayed, by the way, in the series The Untouchables that many people may have seen by the actor Leo Gordon. Frank Nitti dispatched Willie Beoff and a guy named Gordon Brown to Hollywood in order to basically serve as muscle, where they were then employed by the major studio heads as anti-labor goons and were employed in a very, very effective manner in that capacity. Of Roy Brewer, his succession to the head of the IATSE, his association with Disney and the House Un-American Activities Committee, and Disney's central role in the Hollywood blacklist, we read as follows. By the way, this refers to, the reference here is to a strike that Walt Disney, or a layoff that Walt Disney promised in order to precipitate a strike that was in turn used for manipulative purposes, and hopefully that'll become clear as we delve into this text. As promised, 3 days later, Disney laid off 450 workers, declaring the studio was, quote, through with caviar, from now on, it's mashed potatoes and gravy, unquote. The Cartoonists Guild lost no time in accusing him of forcing an illegal lockout and threatened an immediate retaliatory strike. This time, Walt was hopeful the Guild would do just that. Privately, Roy Brewer, who had replaced Willie Beoff as the head of the Hollywood branch of IATSE, told Disney a new strike would give IATSE the opportunity to play hero by regaining the cartoonists' lost jobs and, along with them, their loyalty. The first night after the layoffs, Disney met with representatives of the Guild and found them more amenable than he had expected or hoped. Herb Sorrell, who believed Disney was trying to pull the Guild into another strike, was determined to reach a settlement. Sorrell settled for the rehiring of only 94 of the laid-off cartoonists and 2 weeks' severance for the other 215. The remaining clerical and maintenance workers received absolutely nothing. Disney viewed these concessions as a total victory under the circumstances. Without losing a single day of production, Disney had won a significant reduction of his staff and payroll and severely weakened the Cartoonist Guild's ability to dictate studio policy. Walt then promised Brewer complete cooperation in helping to rid the industry permanently of Sorrell and his fellow insurgents. That opportunity came in November of 1947 with the commencement of HUAC's next series of investigations into the entertainment industry. Now, under the chairmanship of J. Parnell Thomas, a notoriously anti-labor congressman, HUAC received the warm endorsement of IATSE, the American Legion, and the Catholic Church, and the full cooperation of Hollywood studios. A group of left-wing writers, which came to be known as the Hollywood Ten, symbolized the relentlessly persecutory actions of Thomas's investigation. The Ten were deemed unfriendly witnesses after each cited his right under the First Amendment to refuse to respond to the most famous question of the era: are you now, or have you ever been, a member of the Communist Party? All Ten were immediately blacklisted, their careers shattered, and their lives disrupted by jail sentences for contempt. Brewer became the guardian of the industry's notorious and feared blacklist. During HUAC's investigation, the head of the Hollywood branch of IATSE sent letters to every major industry figure, on-screen talent and off, warning that if they didn't now declare their open support for IATSE, they would be considered enemies of the Hollywood establishment. He warned that failure to support IATSE would make them subject not only to industry boycott, that is, inclusion on the blacklist, but investigation by Thomas's HUAC as well. Brewer operated with the full support and encouragement of Eric Johnson. A successful businessman from Seattle, during the war, Johnson had served as the vice president of the United States Chamber of Commerce. He was also a member of the Economic Policy Subcommittee of the State Department's Advisory Committee on Post-War Foreign Policy, and an outspoken foe of the Soviet Union as well. In September of 1945, he was appointed the new president of the Motion Picture Association of America, or MPAA, replacing the far more liberal Will Hayes. Johnson urged the studios to band together and refused to hire anyone who was blacklisted. The time had come, he warned, for Hollywood to fish or cut bait on fighting communism. On November 24th and 25th, 1947, Hollywood's most powerful executives and producers, members of the Association of Motion Picture Producers, the MPAA, and Walt Disney's SIMPP, and Roy Brewer and Eric Johnson convened for a two-day conference held at the Waldorf Astoria in New York. The purpose of the conference was to decide whether the industry would endorse the looming fate of the Hollywood Ten. The result of the conference was a jointly issued proclamation which came to be known as the Waldorf Statement, unquote. It said in part, "We will forthwith discharge or suspend without compensation those in our employ, and we will not re-employ any of the Ten until such time that he is acquitted or has purged himself of contempt and declares under oath that he is not a communist. On the broader issues of alleged subversive and disloyal elements in Hollywood, our members are likewise prepared to take positive action. We invite the Hollywood Talent Guilds to work with us to eliminate any subversives," unquote. Although the Waldorf Statement was intended as a statement of unity, there were many in Hollywood who were concerned about granting so much power to HUAC. To them, the real issue was the film industry's fight right to free expression. Many older members of the Academy in particular, liberals and conservatives alike, remembered what had happened the last time the government had tried to regulate the content of motion pictures. They feared that a return to the type of hysteria that ran through the industry during the 1920s when Congress... a return of the type of hysteria that ran through the industry during the 1920s when Congress had attempted to use the issue of morality as the springboard to create a federal board of censorship. Even some members of Disney's Motion Picture Alliance expressed their concern that an endorsement of HUAC and the blacklist might lead to permanent government regulation and the censorship of motion pictures. However, no one wanted to risk his own career by protesting HUAC's hearings or the legitimacy of Brewer's blacklist. Merely to question HUAC was enough to raise suspicions of political allegiance, and the situation had turned nightmarish. One of the biggest battles that took place following the Waldorf Statement was the decision to invite the industry's guilds to join the fight against communism. The intent was, obviously, to force the guilds either to come out against subversion or risk being accused of it themselves. As a result, no effective coalition of opposition emerged to protest HUAC, and shortly after the Waldorf Statement, the powerful blacklist was born. By May 1947, the mere receipt of a HUAC subpoena implied communist affiliation. An investigation by the FBI's CompPic, or Communist Pictures team of Hollywood-based informers, in which Walt Disney was by now an active participant. Among the first to capitulate to the specter of HUAC and Brewer's blacklist were the leaders of the Screen Actors Guild, one-time liberal Roosevelt supporter Ronald Reagan and song and dance man George Murphy, who hastily convinced their membership to reject Herb Sorrell and the CSU in favor of IATSE. And note that the alleged once liberal Ronald Reagan furthered the career of Roy Brewer when Ronald Reagan became president. In a footnote to the passage I just read you, Mark Elliott writes as follows. According to Dan Moldea in Dark Victory, pages 65 and 69 and 332, quote, Instead of trying to rid the IATSE union of its gangster image and all remnants of mob control, by the way, that was the Frank Nitti, Willie Beoff, Gordon Brown union, beginning again, instead of trying to rid the union of its gangster image and all remnants of mob control, Brewer was obsessed with eliminating the communist influence within the union and the movie industry in general. When Brown and Beoff went to jail, Brewer insisted, that ended any connection with the mob and the IATSE. The truth is that the communists in this the communists had this town in the palm of their hands, and they were calling the shots, unquote. Later, Brewer was appointed by President Reagan in 1984 as chairman of the Federal Service Impasse Panel, which arbitrated disputes between federal agencies and the unions representing federal workers. Ultimately, Walt Disney himself gave lengthy and very important testimony before the House Un-American Activities Committee, and Walt Disney's previously established prestige as an icon of Christian morality, and bear in mind that took place originally with his creation of Mickey Mouse or Steamboat Willie, which is was seen as a major cultural antithesis to the sexual Hollywood immorality of the Jewish studio heads. Ultimately, Walt Disney parlayed that image into a very, very successful political gambit, and his testimony before the House Un-American Activities Committee was very important indeed. After printing some of that testimony, which is quite lengthy, Mark Elliott writes, Disney's testimony before HUAC helped strengthen Brewer's industry-wide blacklist. The mere whisper of a name was enough to eliminate someone from consideration for a job. Because no proof was required, nor any defense short of confession acceptable, the assumption of guilt until proven innocent replaced the constitutional rights of everyone accused and plunged America into one of its darkest political periods. Next, Mark Elliott goes on to write about one of the major casualties of the Hollywood blacklist period, a person who had long been viewed as politically suspect, namely Charlie Chaplin. And he also goes on to note that the blacklist was really only formally lifted when Kirk Douglas insisted that Dalton Trumbo, a member of the Hollywood Ten, be given on-screen credit for having written the film Spartacus that many people may be familiar with. Turning once again to Walt Disney, Hollywood's Dark Prince, by Mark Elliott. Of those most directly affected by the blacklist, some, like the Hollywood Ten, served time in federal prison on contempt charges. Others, including actor John Garfield, died prematurely. Like Sorrell, Garfield suffered a fatal heart attack while still in his late 30s. Still others, like veteran actor Philip Loeb, grew despondent, and their professional lives shattered, committed suicide. And still others, like Charlie Chaplin, were literally exiled. Long a thorn in the side of conservative Hollywood, Chaplin had been immune to the powers of the industry because he himself was one. After amassing a fortune for his work in silent films and his participation in forming United Artists, he began his own studio. Throughout the 30s, up to and including The Great Dictator, he made highly entertaining movies infused with populism. His active campaign for a second front against the Axis powers during World War II and his pleas for the curtailment of anti-communist propaganda angered Disney, who had once so idolized Charlie Chaplin. Chaplin's actions also angered HUAC. After three postponements of his subpoena testimony, he sent HUAC a telegram in which he stated that, quote, I am not a communist, neither have I ever joined any political party or organization in my life, unquote. Although HUAC was apparently satisfied by his response and wrote back that his appearance was no longer necessary, the matter was far from closed. Chaplin, who was British, had never applied for U.S. citizenship. In 1952, at the height of the blacklist era, while Chaplin was on a six-month tour of England and Europe, the Immigration and Naturalization Service barred his return to the United States under a code denying an alien entry on grounds of morals or communist affiliation. Chaplin vowed never to set foot in America again and blocked stateside showings of most of his feature films. Thus ended the Hollywood career of perhaps the greatest single talent the world of film had ever produced. Although Walt declined to comment publicly on the matter of Chaplin's exile, in private, he told one of his nine old men studio loyalists the country was better off without the little commie, unquote. The blacklist remained unchallenged until 1959, when Kirk Douglas insisted that Dalton Trumbo receive on-screen credit for writing Spartacus, a movie with obvious allegorical references to the madness that had infected Hollywood. Still, it would take several more years for many of those denied the chance to earn a living wage to regain their right to a decent life. Later on, Walt Disney was appointed by J. Edgar Hoover to be a special agent in charge contact in Hollywood. This in part because of Walt Disney's loyal service during these dark days, as Mark Elliott put it, and also because Walt Disney had a pivotal role in the new medium of television, and J. Edgar Hoover wanted an informant and an inside man in the television industry. Turning once again to Walt Disney Hollywood's Dark Prince, we read, next to that report was a letter Walt had received from J. Edgar Hoover, the contents of which meant as much to him as the financial report. In his letter, Hoover informed Walt he had been officially promoted to the position of Special Agent in Charge Contact. Here is the confidential 1954 FBI interoffice memo that describes the promotion. Mr. Walt Disney is the vice president in charge of production and the founder of Walt Disney Productions Incorporated, 2400 West Alameda Street, Burbank, California. Mr. Disney is extremely prominent in the motion picture industry, and his company is the foremost organization in the production of cartoons. Mr. Disney has recently established a business association with the American Broadcasting Company for the production of a series of television shows, which for the most part are scheduled to be filmed at Disneyland, a multi-million-dollar amusement park being established under Mr. Disney's direction in the vicinity of Anaheim, California. Mr. Disney has volunteered representatives of this office complete access to the facilities of Disneyland for use in connection with official matters and for recreational purposes. Because of Mr. Disney's position as the foremost producer of cartoon films in the motion picture industry, and his prominence and wide acceptance in film production matters, it is believed that he can be of valuable assistance to this office, and therefore it is my recommendation that he be approved as a special agent in charge, contact, unquote. Being made an official SAC contact pleased Walt greatly because it meant that in addition to continuing to supply his data to the Bureau, other informants could now supply reports to him. It was Hoover's Christmas present to Walt, the timing of which was no accident. Hoover, as he implied in his directive, wanted to capitalize on Disney's involvement with network television. The FBI had thus far been unable to penetrate the middle echelon of the new medium's power loop, and what the Bureau wanted was someone it could trust on the inside. As far as J. Edgar Hoover was concerned, the man most qualified for that assignment was the Bureau's proven Hollywood veteran, the man everyone, including the head of the FBI, called Uncle Walt, unquote. Later on, Walt Disney himself fell afoul, at least for a period of time, of the FBI and of the political right in this country. This because during the early World War II period, he had infiltrated meetings specifically for the purposes of conducting political espionage and providing information on some of the leftists in that meeting. And ultimately, this led to suspicion that devolved on Walt Disney, at least for a period of time, sort of indicating that what goes around comes around and that paranoia is contagious. Turning once again to the last episode of Walt Disney Hollywood's Dark Prince that we're going to read. That same year, 1956, Disney's relationship with the FBI took an unexpected turn. It was a bizarre episode that demonstrated the spreading infection of political paranoia. The FBI had begun to question the allegiance, patriotism, and loyalty of one of its own most revered and presumably immune operatives. The trouble began early in the year, in January, when Disney sent producer Jerry Sims to Washington to finalize plans with the Bureau for a two-minute Mickey Mouse Club newsreel of a group of children touring the Bureau's D.C. headquarters. Sims submitted a preliminary script to an FBI agent identified only as Kemper, who dutifully passed it on to Lou Nichols, the Bureau's head of public relations. Nichols reviewed the material and initially approved the venture. However, a week later, he apparently changed his mind when he returned Kemper's report with a message scrawled in ink across the bottom that read, "I don't think we should," unquote. Kemper then called Sims and told him the Bureau would be unable to assist on the project. When Walt received news of the FBI's turndown, he phoned Hoover to find out why. Hoover told Disney he would personally look into the situation and asked his close friend Clyde Tolson, the Bureau's assistant director and second-in-command, to investigate the matter. Tolson ordered a complete review of what had now become known in FBI headquarters as the Disney situation, unquote, after which he reaffirmed Nichols' decision not to cooperate with Disney. And later on, Mark Elliott writes about just what it was that had led to the FBI's suspicion of Walt Disney. Why had the FBI apparently turned its back on Disney? The answer lay in a confidential internal Bureau memo dated March 21, 1956. Walter E. Disney, summary. Walt Disney, born December 5, 1901, Chicago, Illinois. No investigation has been conducted by the FBI concerning the captioned individual. However, this Bureau's files reflect the receipt of a flyer issued by the Council for Pan-American Democracy advertising the Night of the Americas to be held at the Martin Beck Theater on February 14, 1943 in New York City. The flyer carried a partial list of sponsors and guests of honor, which included the name of Walt Disney. The Council for Pan-American Democracy has been designated to be a subversive organization by the Attorney General of the United States pursuant to Executive Order 10450. The People's Voice issue of January 15, 1944 contained an article captioned, "New Masses Sponsors Tribute to Art Young," unquote. The article set forth that New Masses was sponsoring a mass meeting to pay tribute to Art Young, Dean of American Cartoonists, who died recently. It was indicated that the meeting would be held on January 27, 1944 at Manhattan Center, 34th Street and 8th Avenue in New York City. Among the individual sponsors of the meeting was listed the name Walt Disney, unquote. According to the Special Committee on Un-American Activities in its report dated March 29, 1944, New Masses is a nationally circulated weekly journal of the Communist Party. And, skipping down, the unsigned memo was probably requested by Hoover. Incredibly, some mid-level bureaucrat, unaware of Disney's status within the FBI, had turned up what he believed was information that linked Walt Disney's to subversive communist organizations and activities in the early 1940s. As for the tribute to Art Young, Disney had never made a secret of the admiration for the renowned artist's work and upon Young's untimely death in an automobile accident. Somehow, the FBI had construed from these two incidents that Walt's political loyalties were questionable. They did so in spite of his official SAC status and long history of informing, his anti-communist activities, his government contracts, his involvement with the Hollywood Alliance, his friendly testimony before HUAC, which he had been instrumental in bringing to Hollywood, and his active support of the Blacklist. When Hoover finally read the memo, he was aghast and immediately approved the Mickey Mouse Club segment. In just a second, we're going to conclude For the Record program 301. A detailed and annotated description of this broadcast will be available on the For the Record section of the Spitfire website at spitfirelist.com. For the Record section also has links to two websites that sister station WFMU has with real audio archives of these broadcasts. One of them is wfmu.org/Dave Emery. The other is longer and is linked on that website. This concludes For the Record program number 301, Mickey Mouschwitz, the Reactionary Politics of Walt Disney. This has been recorded on May 10th of the year 2001. My name's Dave Emery. Thanks for listening.